From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we learn about the allegations concerning the leadership of the DNC's host committee, the organization tasked with helping pull off the historic convention. Then we learn about what top food trends you can expect to carry into 2020 from Outpost's local perspective.
We've been that place where people go, and we still find that we are that place where people come to find the newest food trends or plant-based foods in this case. It's definitely been an ongoing trend for us, but we've seen it honestly explode the last couple of years, and this year it's poised to really be big.
Plus, a murder mystery play with an aviation twist hits the road.
We picked our birds that we wanted, and those are picked purposefully, like whether they're predators or not, and then we let that flavor sort of decide the fates of those characters, I think.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. With the Democratic National Convention now less than 6 months away, two leading members of the host committee have been fired. It's the job of the host committee, the civic, nonpartisan arm of the convention, to raise $70 million to stage the massive event and recruit some 15,000 volunteers. But there's been a shakeup with the top leadership of the DNC host committee. President Liz Gilbert and Chief of Staff Adam Alonzo have been fired by the board after allegations surfaced that they supervised a toxic work environment. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigative reporter Dan Bice first broke the story about the investigation. He spoke with WUWM reporter Angelina Mosher Salazar on Tuesday when the two staffers had been put on leave before the decision to fire them.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
So, Dan, I know that you've been reporting on major developments about the inner workings of the DNC and the DNC host committee. Could you tell us a little bit more about the nature of the reported problems?
Right. First, let me explain what the host committee is. There's the Democratic National Convention is going to be held here in July. And there are two arms. There's the political arm that's going to run the convention. And then there's the host committee. And the host committee is, believe it or not, a nonpartisan, nonprofit part of this. And it's supposed to raise $70 million to pay for the convention. And it's also supposed to round up 15,000 volunteers. And it's been plugging along since the middle of last year, trying to raise this money and round up these volunteers. And it turns out that the two top people running this host committee, Adam Alonzo and Liz Gilbert, they're both New Jersey political operatives, were brought in. And there have been a number of concerns expressed in recent days about how they've run the committee and how they've dealt with the staff there. The major allegation is that the committee has a toxic work environment. There's two different reasons for that. I talked with a couple of people who've worked with the committee who are concerned about how, in particular, Adam, he's the chief of staff there, how Adam Alonzo was bringing New Jersey-style politics here, that he was focused primarily on getting contracts to his friends in New Jersey and keeping score as to who he's dealing with here and not promoting Milwaukee to the degree that he should. And then secondly, there's this letter by four former and current female staffers who felt like they were bullied and intimidated by Adam. And they felt that they took their concerns to Liz Gilbert, the president of the organization, and she didn't do anything about it. So just in recent days, those four women wrote a letter, and I wrote about that and, you know, published the letter so people could see it. And on Monday, I wrote the concerns of the two people who formerly were with the host committee about their concerns with what was going on there.
So have you heard back from Adam Alonzo and Liz Gilbert?
Liz hasn't talked. Adam gave me a statement last night saying that he's very proud of the organization that he's built. They've raised close to $30 million of the $70 million that they need to, and he says he'll cooperate with any sort of investigation that goes on. But, you know, at the same time, the allegations are incredibly serious. You don't want to, you know, you don't want to be accused of creating a toxic environment and treating women in a degrading way, which is essentially what the accusations are. So an investigation's been started. The host committee, the board, a four-member board, has hired an investigator from Foley & Lardner, and she started her investigation today. I expect the investigation to move very quickly because this is not a good thing to be hanging over the committee at this time. You know, there's less than 6 months to go before one of the biggest events in the city's history. And everybody involved wants to get this resolved quickly. The only thing is, I'm sure many people have different ideas about how they want it to get it resolved. But almost every major politician in the state has spoken out and said that they're very concerned about the allegations and they're supporting the investigation. Governor Evers said that this afternoon. Senator Tammy Baldwin has issued a statement today saying that she is very concerned about the allegations. Gwen Moore has said the same. And the one politician who's the most interesting in all of this is Mayor Tom Barrett. Mayor Barrett has been a big advocate for Liz Gilbert, the president, who's now one of the two people under investigation. And it'll be interesting to see if, you know, the investigation calls for her to be reassigned or terminated, what he would do in that situation.
But that has yet to be seen.
Right.
I know you just came from a press conference over at City Hall.
Right.
Was there anything informative that came out of that?
Actually, there was one major development that was of great interest to me, and I'm still seeking some clarity on it. But mainly he just said he supported the investigation and was concerned like everybody else. But what I was interested in is I asked him when he got this letter from the four women. He said he saw it first Friday night, and then on Saturday he gave it to the committee. He said executive director. He misspoke. That he gave the letter to the host committee president. That means he got this letter highly critical of Adam Alonzo and Liz Gilbert. And the letter says several times that they brought their concerns to Liz and she did nothing about it. And they felt like they had to go to the board with their concerns because Liz had not done anything. So the mayor got this letter highly critical of Liz Gilbert, and he gives it to Liz to deal with. So I'm very interested in that. And I've already heard from another Democratic politician who says, yeah, I don't think that's what he should have done. But I think the mayor has been fully supported. And I should clarify, the mayor is the co-chairman of the host committee. This is his committee along with Gwen Moore. She's the other co-chair. But you know, that's why I said he's the interesting one to watch, because he's been so supportive of Liz and what she's done.
Now, you mentioned that an internal investigation has kicked off.
Right.
Is there any indication as to how long that investigation is going to last? I know you said you're expecting it to move along quickly, but is there a suspected timeline for this?
If it runs into next week, I would be very surprised. The mayor today tried to emphasize that everything's okay, we're going to get this done and resolved. But I think everybody involved realizes that this is a problem, and $70 million is a lot of money. And so I think they want to get this resolved and move on however they do it. But I think, you know, what they do has to have the support of the staff there at the host committee. And so it's a balance that they're going to have to walk.
So Dan, how is this a problem? Like, help me understand, how could this affect the work and the success of the DNC host committee?
Do you want to give to a committee that is getting headlines because of its mismanagement? You know, some of the complaints are that Adam Alonzo and Liz Gilbert were giving contracts to their buddies in New Jersey. Is that what you want to happen with your donations? For instance, they're very close to the Democratic Party in New Jersey. And the spokesman for the Democratic Party in New Jersey is a company called Vision Media. They hired Vision Media to set up the website for the host committee. They hired Vision Media to run the email platform for the host committee. That's significant money. We don't know how much money it is, but, you know, Liz Gilbert was the executive director of the Democratic Party, and Adam was the deputy chief of staff for the Democratic governor. And you know, one big question that I keep on being asked, and that is, how did the Milwaukee convention end up being run by a couple of people, or at least the host committee, by a couple of people from New Jersey. And it has to do with the power and influence of the governor of New Jersey, Governor Murphy. He's the head of the Democrat Governors Association, and he's the finance chair for the Democratic National Committee. He's a very important person. And so he's taken two people who are very important in getting him elected there. And he's very close to them. He worked at Goldman Sachs for a number of years. Liz Gilbert's father worked at Goldman Sachs for a number of years, still works at Goldman Sachs. And so there's so that's how they ended up being here. But I think there was a culture clash that happened people, and I've worked in other states that have a culture very different from here. And I think, you know, that the culture of New Jersey politics, and I don't think I have to get into details about that, but the culture of New Jersey politics is very different from the culture of Wisconsin politics.
So what I'm getting from you is the number one reason is the ability to fundraise the rest of the money.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the major concern. And plus, I think there's a sense right now that the optimism and the hope that a lot of people had that this would be a great thing for Milwaukee is being lost. So you want to reboot. That's what they want. They want the investigation to occur, the results to be laid out there, and they want to reboot and say, we're back on track. And fundraising's big, but I think there's an atmosphere there that's a concern as well. And it's seeped out to a number of people, not just with the host committee, but to everybody who has a stake in the Democratic National Convention.
That was WUWM's Angelina Mosher-Salazar speaking with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's investigative reporter Dan Bice about the allegations concerning the DNC host committee. You can find more about the allegations and a link to Bice's reporting at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll learn about what food trends are most likely to dominate your grocery trips in 2020. This is Like Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Like Effect continues here on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. As we embark on this next decade, we reflect on the major events of the last 10 years. And one topic that's always on people's minds is food, and more specifically, food trends. Whether you are reevaluating your relationship with food or are determined to try the latest keto or paleo diets, one thing we can count on is a grocery store to fill our changing food needs. The Outpost Natural Foods Co-op has been in Milwaukee for the past 50 years, and it has definitely seen and survived its fair share of food and grocery trends. Whether it's the rise of the chickpea, the rise of yogurt options, seltzers, avocado toast, or plant-based eating, they've seen it all. But what food trends are swaying our appetites as we move into 2020? To find out, I'm joined by Pam Maynard, the general manager of Outpost, and Lisa Malmorowski, its director of brand and store development. Pam and Lisa, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
We're happy to be here.
So Outpost, of course, has been around for 50 years and has been a Milwaukee staple. But when do you think pop culture and the masses really started to seek out organic food widely and in earnest?
Widely and in earnest. Well, I've been working at the co-op for 39 years, so I've seen different waves of people coming through, different trends happening at the same time. The 80s were certainly big for people to discover natural and organic foods, since a lot of tests were being done on pesticides in food and things like that. So that was great, but we were really still a niche business back then at that time. I'd say 2010, 2008, right after the recession, there seemed to be a new wave of people's interest in natural and organic. We saw a lot of the supermarkets picking up some of the same products that we were selling. And it's now a mainstay. It's not a niche market anymore. It's definitely something that people seek out.
Right. And do you feel that you're in a position of strength when you're the one setting the precedence before the supermarkets start picking up on here's this is sourced from this farmer, here's these organic products and things of the like.
I think so. It's always been that way for us, just in terms of the knowledge base that we have at the co-op and the fact that we're dealing with things on such a smaller scale than everyone else, that we can say, oh, you know, here's a local product. It comes from TP Produce. We know Steve, who grew it. You know, he got his degree in agriculture at UW-Madison. And I mean, there's a connection, a people connection, when you think about products from an independent grocer, a smaller grocer like us. So I think that is one of the differences. You know, there's mass market natural foods. There's products grown all over the world. And our niche in the summertime for sure is local.
I imagine you have to adapt to the seasons just like any farmer or seller of the produce, because you need to monopolize on what's fresh right now,
right,
and not rely on things coming from California, say, or anywhere else.
Yeah, I think back in the day we did a little bit more of the sourcing in season than today, because things are grown in so many different places that you're able to get asparagus almost year-round, where back in the day it was definitely we would source local asparagus when asparagus came in Wisconsin, and that's what you would find at Outpost versus, you know, places, South America or other places at the regular grocery store.
Now, the whole image of eating organic, I think, has moved beyond people just eating plants all the time. So, and plants are being used in so many different ways compared to when Outpost first started or when this first trend started happening in the 80s, as you mentioned. So let's go over some current food trends. And do you think it's something you've needed to adapt to, or things that you were just easily able to set up? Like, for example, plants. More people are choosing plants versus having a more vegetarian-based diet, or just looking for meat alternatives, or even dairy alternatives.
Right. I think that for us, we've always been in the position of having a lot of those products. Lucky for us. What's been really great is to be on the receiving end of having much more variety on our shelves than we were ever able to source before. It's become much easier for us to find these products and then offer them to our customers. We've always been the place people come to first when they're wanting to try out something new, or their kid comes home from college and says, "Hey, Mom, I'm vegetarian." And Mom comes to the grocery store and says, "I don't know what to feed them." So we've been that place where people go, and we still find that we are that place where people come to find the newest food trends, or plant-based foods in this case. It's definitely been an ongoing trend for us, but we've seen it honestly explode the last couple of years, and this year it's poised to really be big.
So what other things regarding plants? Like I'm thinking Brussels sprouts are becoming really popular again. They're losing their boiled cabbage image.
Very much so.
They're in restaurants all the time as an appetizer, like either seared or fried or anything like that.
Oh, definitely. We like to say that Brussels sprouts this year are the new kale.
Mm.
And kale hasn't went away. Kale kind of opened the door to the whole world of cruciferous, which a lot of people are like, what's that? It's all the cabbages, all the things that I think have that kind of humble and homely kind of reputation, but people are finding that they're really adaptable. They either have their great own sweet, nutty flavor, or they're good a way to masquerade and be in place of carbs. Like another trend we see is cauliflower. And that, too, is eat it on its own. It's great. It's tasty. But it can also pretend to be rice, or it can be, not pretend, sit in for rice. And it can also be a pizza crust. You know, so those vegetables have really stepped up in people's minds.
Well, and along those lines, oats are being used for so many things. There's oat milk. Now, that especially this last year has come out, where to the point coffee stores have it as a milk substitute. So what other kinds of ingredients within that family are being used as substitution products versus I need bulk oats just for cooking, or, you know, things like that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, oats are interesting in that they can become a milk, like you mentioned, but they can also become an ingredient in food to add more protein or more texture and things like that. They're really sustainable too, and I think that's where all of this kind of comes together. Is a lot of people have been drinking almond milk that uses a lot of water in places that are short on water. Oats are a great substitute for that. Other things coming to the forefront in similar ways are pea proteins and bean proteins. Not like soybeans, where a lot of us are familiar with that, but really like pea protein in things like ice cream to make a vegan ice cream. It doesn't taste like peas or beans. It just, it there's fat in them, there's protein, and it can just masquerade as a dairy product. We're seeing a lot more of that. We're seeing it in crunchy snacks and in burgers and things like that, too.
Now, I imagine operating with your store kind of puts you in a unique position. So we're talking about almond milk, all the dairy substitute. Yet, of course, Wisconsin is in the midst of a dairy farming crisis. And having suppliers that are typically Wisconsin-owned, smaller-scale dairy farmers, how do you balance this? You know, how do you decide, not necessarily decide what to have, but in a world where all these dairy alternatives are being promoted, not necessarily in your store, but just mass media, versus the Wisconsin dairy crisis that we're facing now?
I think it is a matter of balance. I mean, just because something's a trend, it may mean some people try it out and it's not for them. And whereas other people may have a stronger connection to dairy from their childhood. They don't have a problem with dairy. Some people do have a problem digesting it. And there's, I mean, delicious foods coming from Wisconsin, whether it's the cheese industry or whether it's the milk industry and some of the smaller scale milk producers are, you know, doing ice cream, Purple Door in town, and, you know, Sassy Cow is really good at things like that. So we try to promote all of it, because one particular diet, maybe back in the 70s and 80s, was great. We, you know, only sold vegetarian back at that time. And now we're trying to meet people where they're at. So we're trying to really fill all the different needs that people might have in a diet. And we've got great products coming out of Wisconsin. I'd hate to be in a place where we're selling more of dairy products from another state than we are from our own state, because our vision really is to support the local farmers and maintain that.
Another thing that a lot of grocery stores in general have had to compete with is the rise of food delivery services. There's meal kits, you know, taking all the work out of your typical grocery experience of going, having a list, making your ingredients, meal planning for yourself. So how have you tried to remain competitive in that additional market?
Well, that's a fun question. We've actually, last year, probably around this time, introduced our own meal kit. We have an Outpost meal kit, three different varieties that typically feature some value-added meat products that we make in our meat departments in our stores. So we found that, you know, more and more of those kits are becoming more popular. People want ideas on how to cook and how to prepare. We also joined Instacart. So Outpost has a site on the Instacart web page for food delivery, and we see more and more shoppers in our stores with the little Instacart jackets on that, you know, are shopping for other folks. You know, consumers want convenience, and convenience isn't always convenient, but it's definitely the trend of where people are going. So,
do you find it disappointing that that's the trend?
At times, right? Why is everything so rushed and so fast and no one has time for anything? No one has time for cooking anymore.
Well, especially you consider Outpost a place where people are coming to who already have a greater appreciation of their food.
Right.
Who are taking these extra steps to go there. You know.
I guess I think about the time that, you know, in the past when we did cooking classes and we introduced new generations to here's how you use these products. And I see that coming back again. I see that as something that will have a place in the market. It's easy for us to do. We've got experts on staff. It's kind of a natural thing for us to say, here, let us help you figure that out, because some things don't take a lot of time. Crockpot meals, for example, you can start your crockpot when you leave for work in the morning. And if you have one on a timer, it's ready to eat when you come home. You don't have to make that adjustment to say, I've got to pick something up that somebody else has already made, you know, the carryout foods that we, of course, sell as well. So,
I think one of the big challenges as a retailer of any size is that people want a lot of options. The same person today who may use a meal delivery service or a meal kit tomorrow wants to make a home-cooked meal or a gourmet meal with their friends. And that's the challenge, I think, for any retailer, and especially small retailers, to meet that need. But we're also positioned to meet that need because we can react quickly and do smaller bits of it and be more personal with it.
And of course, you need to keep consumer wants and needs in mind. And one thing that is certainly picking up trends is the use of plastic, of packaging. Businesses are daily impact on climate change. So how has that affected what you need to do when it comes to your image or your goals as a store. First, when it comes to adapting to how climate change is affecting your food supply and the farmers, to how you are presenting and packaging your foods in store.
We have a committee called the Plastic Purge Committee, not very glamorous, but it's a cross-functional team, and we are looking at the plastics that we use as an organization. At the same time, challenging some of our distributors or suppliers to do better, but, you know, we got to start at home. 2023, we want to eliminate our use of single-use plastics in our production, petroleum-based plastics specifically. And you would think it's easy. We get a lot of questions from customers and the public at large expecting us to have already done that. But it's really hard, like we talked about, balancing that need for convenience and that drive and that want from our customers with something that is environmentally sustainable. And that's what we're working on right now. We've made, you know, a lot of friends and a few people unhappy by changing out our produce bags to compostable bags. They don't act the same way as plastic. They're made from a plant-based material. They degrade quickly if you leave them in your refrigerator. And that's been a learning curve. So we're trying to take people along on this journey, and it's a challenge to walk that line between being super customer-friendly and meeting people where they're at and yet trying to take them a little bit farther and say, we're in this for the long haul, and we see that what's happening with our environment, and you can be part of the solution along with us.
This really started as an awareness for us as an organization to see what we were doing and the impact that we were making on our planet. And we set part of our sustainability mission changed 2 years ago to really focus on climate, really focus on the things that we're doing now that impact the climate negatively, like add more to the atmosphere or add more to the landfill. And that's really where we're working towards, is lowering that impact, lowering our footprint, because it is something that is changing. I mean, we can see it. We, you know, we're not climatologists, but we can definitely see the impact to some of our farmers when for three springs in a row, they can't get plants into the field because of severe flooding, you know, breaking the 100-year floodplain year one, year two, year three with new records, or the early frost that kills off the apple crop, or, you know, any of those damaging types of events are more regular. And so with that regularity, we believe as a good corporate citizen, we need to take action.
Pam Maynert is the general manager of Outpost Natural Foods Co-op, and Lisa Malmorowski is its director of brand and store development. Coming up next, we stay in the dairy aisle and speak with Christine Hansen, author of the Wisconsin Cheese Cookbook. Lake Effect returns in a moment with that on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's hard to deny Wisconsin's love of cheese. Our nickname is America's Dairyland. We produce more cheese than any other state, and Wisconsin is home to some of the most award-winning cheesemakers in the world. Many of these creameries are featured in the Wisconsin Cheese Cookbook, which takes a deep dive into the state's rich dairy history and highlights recipes from creameries throughout Wisconsin. Christine Hansen is the author of the cookbook, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers last March about the book and the origins of Wisconsin's dairy industry.
If you look at a lot of the cheesemakers, particularly in Greene County and Monroe area, they are now maybe on their third or fourth generation of cheesemaking, but they learned those skills from their ancestors who came from Switzerland. So we can thank Switzerland for all of our wonderful cheese today.
It's funny, my boyfriend is from Greene County. He's from Monroe, Wisconsin, and mm-hmm. we just went to Cheese Days this past year, which also makes an appearance in the back of your book.
Yes, yes.
As one of the many events surrounding cheese in the state of Wisconsin. And I was surprised by how Swiss they really are. You know, they really identify as being Swiss there.
Absolutely. If you drive down or walk, because it's quite small, New Glarus is downtown, you might actually think you're in Switzerland. It's pretty cool. There's a bakery, there's, of course, beer, and there's a real sense of a place farther than Wisconsin.
So I know that there were a lot of cultures that really impacted dairy in the state. What are some of the, you know, non-Swiss cultures that were also big in cheesemaking?
Sure. Well, Italy also has a big cheesemaking tradition, and Belgiosio up in Green Bay in the 70s, the president and founder of Belgiosio Cheese came over from Italy, and same story as the Swiss. He had cheesemaking in his blood, literally. And that's the story there. And what's interesting about that creamery in particular is that the cheesemaker he brought with still works at the creamery. And I was just so tickled to meet him on my visit up to the creamery.
So when you, which is amazing, by the way, but when you look at like Italian cheesemaking, Swiss cheesemaking, and I'm assuming German cheesemaking, what are the differences there?
What's interesting is there's not a lot of differences. It's not like just one country would say, you know, we make goat cheese and we do it the best. It's very different from the wine industry, which is what my background is in covering. So, for example, Cabernet Sauvignon grapes might not do well in a particular state or country and do well in others. But with cheese, it really seems to be, you know, as long as you have a really good, fresh milk source, one that you can access within a couple hours. And that's why Wisconsin cheese is so amazing, because it, not just like Switzerland, it goes back to the cows. So all of these cheesemakers are using milk either from their property or neighbor's property. They're not even traveling across the state with it, which is different than you can say for a lot of other food and agricultural industries.
Yeah. When we talk about the cheese that's coming out of Wisconsin, I think most people go, well, cow milk is what's making cheese here. But what is the breakdown? How much of our cheese is coming from cows? How much comes from goats, sheep?
Most of the cheese does come from cows, which is to be expected. But what I found in researching this book is there's a growing number of goat and sheep milk cheese producers. Sheep's milk is still pretty small. You'll find that more so in the Driftless region of part of the state. Two creameries in my book, Nordic Creamery, and another one I talked to but did not profile in the book, Hidden Springs Creamery. Those two are two good examples of sheep's milk. And then goat's milk seems to be rising in popularity, too. And I think that also has to do with our palates. And, you know, as foodies or home chefs, what we like to cook with and what we're seeing chefs cook with.
What's the difference in the flavor profile that you're going to have in those kinds of cheeses?
Sure. Well, it was interesting when I was reporting this book and visiting with the creameries, I found that my own understanding of cheese really evolved. Like, for example, like most people, I'm very much in love with fresh goat cheese, a chèvre, a log. And I knew that, obviously, that hard-aged goat's cheese existed, but I hadn't really tasted through the varieties. And La Claire Family Creamery up in Malone is a great example. In fact, those cheeses made by the daughter of the founders have won a lot of awards, not just here in the States, but internationally. And those are hard goat's milk cheeses as well.
What does a hard goat cheese taste like versus, you know, a hard cow cheese?
Sure. A lot of times you can't really taste the difference. And I think that really speaks to the skill of the cheesemaker and that they're trying to hit a certain flavor profile. I have to believe that a lot of these cheesemakers have food in mind when they're making these recipes. While there's nothing wrong with having a block of cheddar, a block of goat's cheese or what have you, it's also fun to play around with different recipes. Door County Creamery was one of the creameries I visited in my book, which, of course, is up in Door County in Sister Bay. And they have two types of breeds of goats on their farmstead. One is La Mancha. And what Jesse Johnson told me, who owns the creamery, is that he specifically picks those breeds based on the flavor profile of their milk. And that would include the fat content or sweetness or what have you.
This book features a number of different creameries around the state of Wisconsin. We're not just looking at the southern part or the northern part, but really, you know, the whole thing. What were some of your favorite creameries as you went around the state? And what were some that really stuck out to you?
Sure. Well, that's a difficult question, of course, because you're asking me to choose not only my favorite creamery, but my favorite cheese, maybe. But in terms of experiences, I really was impressed with two in particular that have a very strong visitor experience. So La Claire Family Creamery, they have goats you can see and perhaps even pet on property. I was so thrilled to see a day-old baby goat. As a person who lives in the city and did not grow up on a farm, I was just so tickled by that. They also have attached to the creamery, which you can view through glass walls, a cafe where you can enjoy different food items prepared with their cheeses. So it'd be easy to spend a couple hours there. A similar experience I saw is up at Door County Creamery in Sister Bay. They have goat yoga, which is currently very trendy. They have what I like to think of as a very Sonoma-type experience. I've spent a lot of time in Sonoma. And what you can do is taste the cheeses while looking at the goats on the pasture. I mean, it really doesn't get any more authentic farm-to-table than that.
Goat yoga sounds like it might be fun. Cow yoga, on the other hand, that could get dangerous.
I did not come across that in my research, and I probably would not recommend it.
So this book is full of a lot of different recipes. How did you curate them? Because I'm sure, you know, every creamery is going to have a dozen favorite recipes with their cheese. It's something that they work with every day and most of them for their entire lives.
Well, I really, when I approach the creameries, I try to get them to think not just about what recipes you're releasing on your website or in your product brochures or at trade shows or chefs or whatnot. I really wanted them to think about, you know, what do you make at home with your cheeses? And maybe it's something that is not a written down recipe. It's in your head. Okay, let's work together to write it down. One great example is Belgiosio. They have the La Casata cake is something that the family enjoys every Easter in the spring. And then Sid Cook at Car Valley, one of the recipes that he provided is actually that of his 101-year-old mother. It's an apple pie with a sharp cheddar crust.
I noticed that recipe. I remember a long time ago hearing about a law in Wisconsin that you had to serve apple pie with sharp cheddar. It was this kind of joke thing that was on the internet. And it's such an interesting combination. What is that? It's such like a Wisconsin thing, that the sharp cheddar with apple pie.
Well, they both have, you know, some high acidity, and they just seem to work really well together. I mean, a lot of times you will see apples on cheese plates, chopped up apples along with other fruits. It makes sense.
One of the things I found very interesting about this book was it really didn't shy away from sweet. I think, like, when you get into Cheeseland, a lot of people think savory, but you have a lot of sweet recipes.
Exactly. I think we all know that cheese can be used to make mac and cheese, grilled cheese sandwiches, pizza, and all of those things are wonderful and things I enjoy on a regular basis. But I wanted to really have some dessert recipes. The apple pie we just talked about is one example. Another example is goat cheese brownies, which was provided by La Clara Family Creamery. And Door County Creamery as well, they have a chocolate dish with goat cheese that is super delicious. And so I wanted to really think about cheese as being a 24-hour ingredient. Not that you're going to stay up all night eating cheese, although that might actually be fun, and I would totally do that.
Before.
Exactly. Let's admit it. But thinking about, okay, in breakfast, maybe you want a Mediterranean quiche with cheese or biscuits, and then for lunch, a salad or flatbread. And then dinner, of course, there's the traditional recipes, but so much more. I have a recipe for cornmeal crusted fish tacos.
The
cheese that's used with that has a mango habanero flavor, and that gives it a really nice bite.
We've already talked about, of course, the cultures that informed sort of our origins of cheese. But one of the people you profiled I thought was very interesting, her journey to cheese. Huma Siddiqui, am I saying her name?
Yes,
right? Huma Siddiqui. Tell me a bit about her story.
She, I actually found online. I mean, the power of the internet. I just kind of searched for different cheesemakers because I had not tried her cheese before. It's pretty limited distribution, but she's based in Madison, and she is from Pakistan. So she's a really great example of a female entrepreneur. And the spices that she uses in her cheeses are, I mean, normally you would see those spices in the recipes from her native country, but she's added them to the cheese. And I just thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, and an interesting approach, mixing what is her home country with, you know, a very Wisconsin staple.
Exactly. I mean, she could easily make orange cheddar and call it a day, right? But she decided to have her own flavor, literally, in her cheese line.
The book actually introduced me to a couple recipes that I'd never heard of. One of them was, I'm going to massacre this, gougère. Mm-hmm. Perhaps, like a choux pastry with cheese?
Yeah, we can thank the French for those. They're delicious.
And choux in general.
Right.
And you mentioned this before, la cassata. So I Googled that, and it's this terrific-looking Italian cake with all of this, you know, accoutrement on the top.
Right, exactly. And that's from Belgiosio, which, as are all the recipes in my book, include the cheesemaker's products. So literally, you know that Belgiosio has all those products that are dairy-related, at least. But also, you know, there are going to be cases where maybe you can't find a particular cheese based on where you're shopping. And what I like about this book is that it's okay to use another blue cheese or another cheddar, particularly if you're listening and you're not in Wisconsin or Illinois or Iowa or Minnesota at all.
And they may not have them there.
Right, right.
Well, Christine, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me today.
Thank you. This was really fun.
Christine Hansen is the author of the Wisconsin Cheese Cookbook, creamy, cheesy, sweet, and savory recipes from the state's best creameries. She spoke with Lake Vexjoy Powers last March. After the break, we'll introduce you to a playwright and an illustrator who teamed up on a bird-themed murder mystery. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Two graduates of the University of Minnesota are nearly halfway through their year-long tour of the country. But they're not just sightseeing. Along the way, they're performing a play that one of them penned. Oliver Bestill wrote The Birding Body, a bird-themed tongue-in-cheek murder mystery. Veronica Swanson illustrated a booklet that accompanies the play, and it allows for audience members to play along as the characters try to figure out who done it. They'll have their finale performance at Milwaukee's Pabst Theater this coming September. But far ahead of that final performance, Bestill and Swanson sat down with WUWM's Mayan Silver before they took the play on tour last September. They began by explaining why they decided to take the show on the road.
Well, Veronica is a park ranger-to-be, so we're using this cross-country tour as an excuse to see a lot of the state and national parks across the country. So that's how we kind of decided on our map. And, we kind of went off from there. A lot of maybe 10 large cities and then the rest small towns throughout the country.
And explain the plan about, you know, how you decided what direction to go and where to cover first.
Yeah, so Oliver's job this summer was pretty much putting this whole map together of where we're going. And he decided to go West Coast first because it's more of the driving, like the big states out of the way, and we wanted to kind of follow the seasons. And so we're doing West Coast for the fall, then going south for the winter, and then coming back up the East Coast as summer occurs.
And what are you particularly excited about? I mean, I'm sure it's all kind of exciting, but what are you looking forward to?
I think I'm looking forward to Texas the most and seeing like a rodeo and just experiencing parts of the country that I've never seen before.
And I took a lot of road trips as a kid. That was already always sort of our summer adventures. And so I've seen a lot of the national parks and things like that. But this was when I was like 6 or 8, and I don't have a lot of memories about it because, you know, I look up briefly from my Game Boy and see the Grand Canyon and then go right back to it. So I'm excited to appreciate it a little more and definitely to show it to Veronica. I'd say Utah is one of my favorites as far as parks are concerned, with the arches. The whole state kind of looks like you're on Mars. Besides that, I think South Dakota is kind of underappreciated because it's got the, you know, the kitschier Mount Rushmore type deals, but you've also got, you know, the Badlands and things like that. So I think we got a lot going right in our backyard. So.
And the whole reason you're doing this tour is to put on the 45-minute murder mystery play that you came up with. Can you give me a little synopsis of the play?
Sure. So the play is called The Birding Body. It was written by Oliver, and then the little booklet is illustrated by me. And the whole premise of the play is that there's a detective in town to look into the murder of one woman. And as he's doing that, he discovers there may actually be a second murder in town. And so the whole play is based around him kind of finding clues and figuring out who murdered this second woman.
And there's basically, it's a two-person play. There's a dialogue between the detective, but then also who's the second character?
The second character is actually the second murder victim. So she kind of comes back to life as sort of a figment of the detective's imagination, but she has kind of her own personality, and she's helping him figure out the clues.
And do you play the second victim?
Yes, yeah, I'm the dead woman.
Yes. What is the acting like? Like, what is the tone of the play?
I would call it pretty lighthearted. When I get that question, I usually compare it to like an episode of the TV program Columbo, maybe. So it's like a lighter play, pretty family friendly.
One more thing. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Wait a minute. Lighthearted. There's a lot of jokes, a lot of humor involved, especially with Veronica's character. She comes back as sort of like the sassy deceased. So that's pretty fun. And it was a challenge because being a two-person production, there's no set changes or anything like that. It all takes place in the kitchen of Violet Veery. That's Veronica's character. And so one of the tricky parts was figuring out how you can unveil like a 45 minutes worth of clues and discussion with just what you have in a kitchen. So it was an interesting challenge for the both of us, I'd say.
Well, how did you come into the idea of doing a whodunit murder mystery in the first place?
I was watching a lot of Columbo or that type of program. I always kind of enjoyed the detective-y side of it. And then a lot of our projects have sort of a morbid twist. So we couldn't really resist having like a zombie basically in the show.
And what about the bird theme? It's called The Birding Body. There's illustrations of a cockatoo that is very adorable. There's birds. Bird watching is kind of a theme throughout. Where did that come from?
I'm obsessed with birds. I don't know. I think it might have just been like one of the interests that sort of filtered into another project of ours. Yeah.
Yeah. I just think that the crowd is very specific, the ornithology crowd. and I thought it'd be kind of interesting. What if we had a whole town of ornithologists, basically, and what sort of hijinks? What could happen in a town like that? I don't know. I thought it was interesting.
And you know what's interesting about this play is that it's kind of timeless in that it could have been set, you know, 50 years ago. There's not an element of technology or of like 20, you know, this millennium, that kind of thing. Can you talk about that?
I'd say that was pretty much on purpose. I'd call both me and Veronica old souls. We met in college and haven't had cell phones for the last 3 years since we started hanging out pretty much. And we're sort of backwoods, hermits when it comes to the modern era or whatever. We don't have any social media presence or anything like that for the play. It's really just two people hitting the road with a bunch of flyers, basically. That's sort of our style. And our last project was the Inside the Swan Tomb, and that was an 1830s setting, and it took a lot more research, and it was a lot more serious play. And this one, I think we just sort of wanted to have fun. Let's just set it any old time. Even the props we use in the play, it's sort of a hodgepodge. You can pretty much pin it to whatever time you prefer.
And you mentioned you have manila folders with clues, and do you illustrate those?
Yeah, so the illustrations inside of the manila folder are all the same illustrations that are in the book. So when the audience comes, they each get a little manila folder so they can follow along with the clues. We'll have a little bell that dings during the play for you to turn your page. And they're all the same illustrations that are in the book.
And what's your illustration style? Can you describe that a little bit?
Sure. It's pretty simple. Just kind of like little black lines, nothing crazy, just like really easy little kind of almost childlike in a way, but they're, I mean, I hope they're at least somewhat accurate.
This is actually a very cool illustration right here. It's a woman with a hat on and sunglasses. It kind of looks a little Carmen Sandiego-ish.
Yeah, it does. You're right. Yeah.
One of the suspects, Simone Bettelur, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
How did you come up with the characters?
Well, each of the last names in the story is actually the name of a species of bird. So Violet Veery is a bird, Veery. Then there's Simone Bettelur. That's a French hawk of sorts, I think. I was doing a little bit of light research. So because it's a French hawk, Simone and Celine, two of the characters in the play, are French characters. There's a Shikra, I think is like an Indian hawk. So Jashan Shikra is a gentleman from India and things like that. So we picked our birds that we wanted, and those are picked purposefully, like whether they're predators or not. And then we let that flavor sort of decide the fates of those characters, I think.
And what are you expecting from like performing it so many times with so many different places and different contexts?
I feel like it's going to change over time. You know, the first showing is not going to be the same at all from the last showing, because we'll probably grow into our characters more and to decide to take it a different way, you know, even if it's just to not get bored of it, because performing it this many times for a whole year, it's going to be a lot. So I guess I'm excited to see it kind of grow.
Yeah, I'm anxious to come back to Milwaukee, because that's like our 50th stop, and that's when we'll really have it down pat, I think. I think that'll be us at our best, and that's in 2020 September. But yeah, that should be fun.
Well, good luck, Oliver and Veronica.
Thank you.
Yes, have fun.
Will do.
Oliver Bestill and Veronica Swanson spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver before taking the Birding Body on tour. They'll bring the year-long tour to a close here in Milwaukee at the Pabst Theater in September. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect that's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.